Drama on One.
Sundays at 8 p.m.
rte.ie/drama on one.
Drama on One.
This is RTE Radio 1. Drama on One is offered as a podcast at rte.ie/drama on one. And of course here on RTE Radio 1 on Sunday nights. Tonight on Drama on One, The Four-Faced Liar by Ger Fitzgibbon. It's part of the lore of Cork City that the four clocks on the four faces of Shandon Steeple rarely agree on the exact time, hence the nickname, The Four-Faced Liar. In tonight's play, each of the four liars has a voice. With our narrator, they guide us on a journey through the night world of Cork, through the hidden streams that flow underneath the city, and through the dreams and desires that flow through its people, whether past or present. The play stars Andrew Bennett, Dawn Bradfield, Dennis Conway, Orla Fitzgerald, Elizabeth Moynihan, Alex Murphy, Gary Murphy, Tatiana Ulyankina, and Norma Sheehan. The original score on saxophone is performed by Brian Wynne. And just a note that the programme contains some strong language along the way. This is The Four-Faced Liar by Ger Fitzgibbon, directed by Charlie McCarthy.
It is 3 a.m. High in its tower over the city, the iron tongue of Shandon Steeple is silent now, and the great clocks on its four faces just click and cluck and grumble quietly amongst themselves.
Oh, I have 10 past. What if she?
Don't mind her, she stopped altogether.
I'm exactly 3.
I'm nearly 3.
A soft mist slips down the cascade of roofs towards the sluggish oil slick of the river, where the gulls dip and ride, half asleep on the cold black water.
Who's that?
Shh, that's the narrator.
The early gulls.
Excuse me for breathing, like.
Who is he?
Shh, I don't know. Maybe it's the goldie fish up on top.
Shh, he sounds very posh, doesn't he?
Yeah, he sounds kind of tall.
I don't think he's from around here at all.
Shh. Oh, he talks lovely, don't he?
Shh. Listen.
The mist drifts down over Merchant's Quay and Patrick Street, where the roughish sleepers groan and turn in their unlit doorways. Down over Washington Street, where the last steel barrels are trundled out of Reardon's to squat, gleaming sullenly on the footpath.
After all that we've been through.
And a late drunk meanders down Little Hanover Street.
I know that we fight and our love gets pushed. That's it. Still it ends all right.
Over at the courthouse, the mist curls around the pillars and down over the entrance steps below. The young lawyers, old guards, defendants and their colour parties are all gone now. The steps are empty, apart from two bleary revellers about whom the mist pauses and eddies.
Ah, will you look at him? Only 16 and 17.
For sure, God love us.
She sits, her head hanging and her eyes shut tight as she struggles to keep a grip on the last remains of a fish supper.
Go on, Caitlin, I'm telling you, you'll feel better.
Shut up.
I'm only saying, get it out.
Shut up.
Oh, Jesus, on me shoes and all.
That's disgusting, that is.
Do we have to have that, like?
Night moves through the streets like a ghost in slippers. On Oliver Plunkett Street, it gathers up the crisp packets near the Centra and organises them neatly outside the Bowron. Like a cheque in a brown envelope, Knight slips down Cook Street beside the bank and into the pocket of the self-important Mall, where it pauses to check the desirable properties in the windows of superior estate agents, and saunters along to the Imperial Hotel.
The Imperial? There's posh.
The Imperial Coffee Dock is empty now, apart from the ghostly echoes of its comfortable customers.
Honestly, no, George, they were as good as anything you'd hear in Stuttgart or Paris.
He had us completely caught in starboard, so we had to go about again, and we lost about 25 seconds. Otherwise, we would have had the Admiral's Cup.
Marvellous, really. You know they have a place down in Skull.
Oh, Skull is getting very common, though, isn't it? Full of Dublin people.
Sure, Kinsale's is bad. Could hardly get in with all the STDs.
What? It's SUVs, Marjorie, SUVs. STDs are something else entirely.
Knight slides down an alley past the Gothic skeleton of the Holy Trinity. Pauses on Parliament Bridge, then wanders down Sully's Quay towards Sober Lane. It leans on the iron balustrades by the river and exhales a ghostly miasma. It empties itself of all longings and regrets, would-haves and should-haves, in a slow turbulence of fears and desires that will haunt the dreams of the sleeping citizens. High up in Daunt Square, in the tiny bedroom of her tiny flat,
Misha Pasternak, 34,
runs down the slippery corridors of her dream, wrestling with her duvet as she reaches to catch up with her elusive desire.
His eyes are all smiley, like Brad Pitt. And his voice, oh my, his voice is like that foxy barman from the corner house. And just at the top of the stairs, I have him in my grasp. But suddenly, he's a fish in my fingers, and he wriggles, and he's gone with a flick and soft splash. Раз, два, а, меня укачал.
And in her sleep, she grieves over her lost love and hugs her deflowered coverlet. Below the cathedral in his sloping terrace,
Bertie Murphy, 46,
widower of this parish, carpenter and handyman, eases his aching shoulder and dreams of being
a magician with a top hat and silky trousers, and I'm helping into a box that I made myself. My gorgeous assistant, that farm girl from the checkout and the builder supplier.
Hello, Bertie.
And she's all spangles and fishnet tights.
As the kettle drum rolls, he flourishes his silver saw, draws it across the box to the oohs and ahs of the fascinated crowd. And he saws her magically in half. He suavely smiles and bows, but when he straightens and swivels towards his assistant, throwing his arm out in a formal reverence, it is his late wife, Dora, standing there, blank, pale and unsmiling in a white shroud, her bare feet covered in earth.
You should marry again, Bert. Marry again, for my sake.
I couldn't do that, Dora.
Yes, you could. Of course you could.
But I even stammer in my dreams. I'd never manage.
Not when you sing, pet. You sing gorgeous. Sing to her.
And Bertie lies awake, thinking about the foreign girl on the checkout. He sings to her. The four faces of Shandon are unimpressed.
I couldn't put up with that old singing. I don't know what that Dora ever saw in him.
Saw in him. That's funny.
What's funny?
He's a carpenter, isn't he?
Oh, yeah, that's funny.
Sad, though. Sure, who'd have him now? The leavings. God help us, like.
High up in St. Luke's,
Afric McKendrick, 16, if you must know,
is asleep in bed. In her dream, Afric is on holiday with Roz, her new online BBF.
Roz is so clever and funny and inquisitive-like, and she knows, like, everything about underwear and boyfriends and stuff because her dad has this new partner who is like almost her own age, which is kind of gross, but it means she knows literally tons about all kinds of stuff. But it's just so great to have this like secret cool online friend, and all my school friends are so jealous. Even Daphne. She keeps rolling her eyes and talking about predators and perverts on the internet. Honestly.
In snug Ballantemple, almost Black Rock,
Morgan O'Carroll, 57.
Known to his rivals as Morgan the Box, but known online as 16-year-old Rosalind, or simply Roz to his new BBF, lies slimly awake, still as a fish, motionless beside his dear wife Barbara. Mr. O'Carroll, a well-respected undertaker of great cleanliness and sensitivity and an upstanding knight of Columbanus, is desperately trying to remember where he has left his private pay-as-you-go iPhone, the one he uses as Roz.
Was it downstairs in the lounge when I was watching the late-night golf? Or in the car? I did turn it off, though, didn't I? Oh, God. Maybe if I move very quietly, I can get...
Shit. Ooh, Morg, you awake?
He doesn't like being called Morg, but she finds it witty.
Morg. Morgie. You're awake, I can hear you. Morgie, how about a quick, you know?
What?
You know, an old gallop.
And she pokes his skinny ribs with her thick finger.
No.
The bed creaks and she rolls her great bulk towards him. Later, he listens to her snores and stares bleakly up into the darkness. Compared to his wife, he is so light he almost levitates. So light, the sag at her side rolls him down towards her, a move she often misinterprets. Now he clings to the edge of the bed and struggles to conjure up Afric, his dream girl, against the sound of ongoing roadworks beside him.
I don't understand that at all. How can he be Rosalind?
You're very innocent, you know that.
Yeah, but he's a man, like. How can he be Rosalind?
Oh, sure up, will you? You're only making an idiot of yourself.
All right, I was only asking. How can he be...
Yeah, we know.
I'll explain it to you later.
Back in the city, slow and exotic as a flamingo, a Garda car banks and slides onto Patrick Street. The headlights sweep along the pavement, past Patsy Dunn in his cardboard shelter made from a Zanussi freezer box, on past all the rough sleepers with hardly a blink. The car swings slowly around by Daunt Square and onto the Grand Parade, its headlights scanning the stragglers near Singer's Corner. But its grill is nosing the smell of curry and chips from Hillbilly's Takeaway. The car pauses a moment to consider a drunk middle-aged man who is pissing into the ornamental fountain.
Needs must when the bladder dries.
God, would you look at that?
I've seen one before, girl.
But in the fountain? I mean, has he no decency?
Watch now, the guards are there.
They'll do nothing.
Useless.
And sure enough, the Garda car glides on down towards Fleet Park, where the stone one-legged soldier stands in his lonely vigil beside the river. Up at the courthouse, in a shaded doorway, the young lovers are locked onto each other, mouth on mouth, in an adolescent frenzy of romance and dry humping.
Ah, that's lovely, all right.
Shut up and listen.
Come on, Caitlin. You know you want to.
Not here, I told you.
And the mouths lock on again, so blearily passionate they would be hard-pressed to know which tongue was which, or whether the dizziness they were feeling was desire or drink, or simply forgetting to breathe.
Jeez, girl, you're driving me mad here.
Come on, so, I'll sneak in up home. Have you got the things?
What about your dad?
Nah, he'll be up by now. Come on, Ryan. Have you got a thing?
Yeah.
Come on.
And so they make their way onto North Main Street, where he has left his trusty steed, a 12-year-old Yamaha 150.
They're fierce young, though, aren't they?
Why? What age were you the first time you...
Never you mind. I'm just saying.
Away from the river, in duvet-like Douglas, deep, deep under a fine old-fashioned quilt from the Munster Arcade.
Muriel Power, 78.
Slow cooks quietly through the night. It was midnight when she began her bedtime odyssey, and now her pink furry Cinderella slippers are dutifully by the bed like camp little sentries awaiting their mistress's bunions. But in her dream she is roasting, surrounded by her Crawford Cafe companions, but next to a large fireplace, so she is toasting all down one side. Her companions have gone crazy, and vicious, lady-shaped nuns with fiery hats poke her with knitting needles towards the waiting flames, where she will roast and roast until she pops up like a piece of toast, wide awake.
God almighty, that was awful. I have to cool down. This flannelette is too warm altogether.
Is she having a stroke or what?
Remember the ad about the burning sensation?
Shut up, will you, and listen.
What's happening? Am I dying? This isn't even my good night, eh? Oh, God. Who will find me in the morning?
But through these whirling thoughts, a scorching heat persists. And with sudden relief, it dawns on her she has left her electric blanket on again. She turns it off, slides her bunions into those awful slippers, and makes a tottery foray to the bathroom for a small pee and a sit-down in the cool, then shuffles briskly back to her too warm bed.
She'd want to check that bed. Could be smouldering or anything.
And it's the smoke that kills you.
Like an animal following the darkness, the night mist slinks around the streets, its cloudy breath veiling the full moon. It smells the old river courses that run like veins under the city, the weft and plash of hidden waters, Ishkafwy Hollow, and it follows them, sniffing the ground. It drifts around the fountain where the drunk man, who, now that he has raised his head, we can see is Gussie Barrett, 61.
Hey, that's Gussie Barrett.
It's not Gussie, is it?
Wasn't he Lord Mayor one time? He looks kind of wrecked, don't he?
Sure you know about him, don't you?
What about him?
Tell you later.
Look at him, lad, going round in circles.
That's all he ever did.
Gussie does seem to have lost his companions, his sense of direction and his zip, as he revolves in a baffled circle, searching for a familiar landmark to point his way home, and realising, too late, that the Garda car had put him off his stride and that he hadn't quite finished the business he had started.
As I sweep the streets of Cork. Where they all gone? Shaggers. Where they all gone?
The state of him.
Like a damp cat, the night mist rubs its cheek against the old bollard at the corner of Tucky Street, hearing the gurgle of the culverts beneath. It hangs there, in the spaces near the monument, empty of skateboarders now. And finding the library closed, it curls around itself and sits listening. Listening to the city's slow music.
What's that?
What?
The music. I'm hearing music.
What kind of music?
Dunno. It's nice though.
Where's that coming from?
Way, way over there.
Over at the airport nearly. Oh, I know. It's that place. Direct Provision. Someone's listening to music there.
They'll wake everyone up. Nah. Headphones.
How can we hear it so?
We hear everything, girl. Can't sleep, I suppose.
Yeah.
Missing home. Mali.
What?
That's where your man is from. Mali.
Where's Mali?
Africa, someplace.
Africa. Africa's fierce big, isn't it?
Yeah.
A long, long way away.
Thank you.
Not everyone is asleep. In her small flat over on Grattan Street,
Eamor Foley, 98, had never been kissed.
Lies enveloped in blankets underneath her bed.
What's she doing under there?
She feels safer.
From break-ins,
druggies,
and free staters.
She has a kitchen knife and her dad's old Webley revolver.
You wouldn't want to mess with her.
She lies there, staring at the shadows on the wall and plotting the overthrow of the coalition government.
Where are you, Dada? Dada? Are you still out there? In the long grass with your Mauser? Are you still there, Dada?
Yes, Eamor. I'm still here. I'm still here, Machree.
What are you doing there, Dada? Killing blackened hens, is it? Or free staters?
Standing guard, the store. Standing guard.
Over what, Dada? Over what?
Over the woodland grave of the friend that I killed. But you know nothing of that, Milanov. You know nothing of that.
I'll kill them all for you, Dada. Honestly. I have placards. Oh, they hate placards.
Mahan Colleen, keep the faith.
Faith of our fathers, Dada. Faith of our fathers living still.
In spite of dungeon fire and sword.
And their voices blow away in the misty air, echoing over the housetops and back out to the Republican plot in St. Finbar Cemetery, where the arguments among the unquiet dead are still going on.
Murders.
Who was De Valera anyway? Only the illegitimate son of a Spanish waiter.
Grabbers.
Who gave the ceasefire?
I always knew he was a double agent.
What about those Trotsky guys?
Second farmers.
I never agreed with the bicycles that
day. What assassination? T'was an ambush, an act of war.
Will you shut up? There's a special branchman over there.
Someone must have told him.
What?
That it was a Republican plot.
Very funny.
It's no laughing matter.
And we should have finished the job when we had the chance.
And on. And on and on. Far away up Western Road, an ambulance keens as it winds its way through its own echoes towards the Mercy Hospital. And from one of the high hills, the mosquito buzz of a small Yamaha as it zigzags up Ascension Road, bearing the lover and his lass with a hey and a ho and a sudden stop to puke again. Back in his terrace, Bertie Murphy is dreaming again. In his dream, his hands are cupped and overflowing with brass screws and cans of teak oil. To his horror, in his mouth, he feels the prickly stem of a red rose. And when he tries to talk, there is nothing but thorns. And there she is, his dream girl behind the counter.
What can I do?
Slowly, carefully, he offers her his mouth with the red rose right there beside the cash register. She leans towards him and softly, softly takes the rose stem in her own mouth, a bead of red appearing on her lip where a thorn caught. But it doesn't seem to hurt her because she smiles and smiles, all teeth, and crunches and chews the stem and the rose, swallowing it all down delicately and looking at him across the counter, her ruby lip rubier than ever.
Oh, if only...
To his astonishment, his own mouth opens and a song flows out.
La si darem la mano, la mi dirai di si.
On Grand Parade, between the culverted streams and the hanging mist,
Garda Karen Crean, 32,
keeps the engine of the Garda car running, adding its own little self-important plumes to the gathering smog as the windows of her patients steam up. There is no sign of her partner,
Dan Considine, 25,
who went to check on the man exposing himself near the fountain 15 minutes ago.
You stay there, girl. Chillax.
The car is clammy and uncomfortable, and her uniform feels too tight, so she is in no humour for the antics of her lazy patrol buddy. Her suspicion is answered when the door opens and Dan slides back into the passenger seat, smelling of chips, vinegar and burger.
I feck it, Dan. You said you were going to deal with your man.
He was gone when I got there, sure. Here, I bought you back a burger.
I don't want an effing burger. I hate burgers.
You're right. You're bursting out of that uniform.
Shut up, you.
Just have to eat it myself.
God almighty, the stink of that stuff. I'm winding down the windows.
Ah, Karen, it's freezing cold.
Well, if you wanted to control the windows, you should drive yourself.
She slides the car into gear and they resume their surveillance. Up Grand Parade, past Argos, down Paul Street, pausing again for a look down St. Paul's Avenue, always dark and dodgy.
Hey, no need to go looking for trouble. Typical banner, huh?
Dan, I'm warning you.
All right, only slagging, can't even make a joke these days.
But all is quiet, and so the car slides on its way under the red sandstone cliffs of Peter and Paul's and back towards Patrick Street. Night in the city flows on, running under and beside and right through these woes and joys, indifferent to all, the Serpentine River, the Lee.
Ah, the Lee. Where's it all come from anyway?
Wasn't it driven out of Gougon that time?
Oh, by St. Patrick, yeah?
No. St. Finbar. St. Finbar done that. Sure wasn't it in Gougon Barra? St. Finbar's Gougon.
What's a Gougon?
I never liked to ask. Anyway, didn't he drive it east from his Gougon, gathering all the rain off the mountains? It's always raining there.
Just waiting for the right moment when it'll burst through the dam and come rushing down to Carrigrohan.
Washing the bones in the graves by the river,
grabbing the ankles of swimmers out in Hellhole,
flooding over the Lee fields and into the city.
Unnoticed by the four faces, His Honour Gussie Barrett has made it as far as the bus station, onwards across four lanes of miraculously empty quay towards the riverside. On the bridge, he pauses midstream to look down at the waters below and gaze into the deep, murky eyes of the river beneath. The slush and gurgle of the water below reminds him, perhaps, of some unfinished business. But the four faces take no notice, not yet finished their scale of the great river.
Then, when it gets to the city,
it gets real snaky. It hides itself,
slipping down the two big channels, winding its coils through the city centre,
sliding underground into little streams and tunnels.
Culverts. That's what we call them. Culverts.
Like veins through the city.
Beneath the Coal Quay and Patrick Street.
And Grand Parade and the Mall.
Rushing under the roads themselves. And it slides right through and under the city and out the other side. Pushing all the way through, away out, free, into Cork Harbour. On a past Gravel Bay and off out into the salty sea.
That's the river for you now.
Ah, look!
Oh, God, is he going to jump? Oh, jeez, no, not another one.
Look too long in the eyes of the river.
Look, la, he's leaning over and staring straight down.
Sure, God love us.
Yeah, tragic.
Ah, look. Tragic me arse. He's only having a slash in the river.
Come here. That's Gussie Barrett again. What's wrong with him?
He's after having a few jars. What goes in must come out.
I know, but seriously.
Got caught dipping the funds, didn't he? One for you, two for me, you know, that kind of thing.
And he lost his wife and all. He nearly lost himself by the look of him.
The long COVID.
No.
Yeah, terrible. Couldn't speak to her or anything.
Sure, they didn't speak to each other for years.
Still, terrible.
He's on the jar ever since.
And so they go, recounting Gussie's crimes and misdemeanours, on into the night. Over the morning traffic, the bells announce a new day. In Douglas, the distant echoes of the Shandon bells do not trouble Muriel, who seems to be sitting on her stairs in a slightly odd position.
Why is she sitting there? What's wrong with her?
Muriel has joined the great conversation in the sky. Below her, at the foot of the stairs, is the culprit, a furry pink Cinderella slipper which, as she hurried downstairs to answer the phone, had slipped off her foot and caused her to tumble, not into the arms of Prince Charming, but into the unsympathetic embrace of a mahogany newel post.
And look at her there now. She looks like she's only having a rest. Apart from the bruise, it's like a big purple flower tucked into her hair.
Garda Karen Crean, off duty and back in civvies, is sitting on a toilet seat. She holds a small plastic device in her hand and watches intently as the colour changes ever so slowly. A faint blue cross appears. Positive.
Fuck!
Up Ascension Road, a 12-year-old Yamaha 150 is lying wrecked in a ditch across the road from the girlfriend's father's front gate. It lies where Caitlin's da, who was not out of it, picked it up and threw it last night to express his disapproval of Ryan. Above St. Luke's, Afric is in her hallway, a piece of toast sticking out of her mouth. She checks her phone, then glares around her, looking for a pair of hockey boots which have mysteriously disappeared from the place she absolutely left them.
It's so unfair! I know I put them out this morning. Why can't everyone just leave my stuff alone?
In sunny Ballintemple, Morgan the Box is up, breakfasted, dressed and dapper, making last adjustments to his person for a 10 a.m. funeral.
Big Fianna Fáil funeral. The press will be there.
Chair of the local coming. His people come from Buttevant or somewhere.
They'll all be down in their anoraks, smelling of brandy and horses.
Married money, though.
Lovely house in Blackrock.
Always very smart. You'd never think he was Fianna Fáil.
As the car eases along towards the church, Morgan congratulates himself quietly.
Damn it. Afric. Later. Later. Can't deal with Afric just now.
But as he pulls into his priority parking space, he catches a glimpse of a large, crude placard with the words Quislings, Traitors, Collaborators. Sitting on the front steps of the church, a small, defiant figure, swaddled in layers of coats topped with a black bin bag and a 1950s hat.
She got lovers, and she great all the same, though. Never misses a big funeral. Mad as a box of frogs, of course.
And the placards and all.
There's Morgan the Box now. Look at the puss on him.
Watch now, watch now. Look at the old smile on him, trying to charm her.
Barking up the wrong tree there, Morgan, old son.
Good morning, Mrs. Foley. And how are you today?
Fuck off.
Now, now, Mrs. Foley. Language, please. We all understand you have very strong feelings about situations.
Leave me alone, you blue shirt, you. You're as bad as them. Dev's warriors with their dig-outs and their checks from Big Fella and their Chevy shirts and their backhanders and their...
Now, Mrs. Foley, you can't be making an exhibition of yourself.
Don't you tell me what I can or I can't do. Are you threatening me? Help! Help! He's threatening an old woman! He's threatening an old woman! We will be true to thee till death!
In the backyard of 23 Grattan Buildings, Lower Glanmire Road, through his hangover, Gussie Barrett is still pondering his moment of epiphany when he gazed into the crocodile eyes of the river. He is stoking a small bonfire near his waste bin. In the tiny yard, no matter which way he moves, the smoke follows him and gets in his eyes. He throws some more paraffin on the embers and adds some more clothes. He knows he should take them to one of the charity shops on North Main Street, but...
I just couldn't do it, girl. I'd be there walking down Paul Street someday and suddenly there you'd be in front of me. Your good coat and hat crossing the road. Nah, it would kill me. and after the hames of the COVID funeral and all, nah.
Oh, Gussie, my good coat gone up in smoke like that. But then you never liked it.
I did so like it.
And the lovely red hat, that time we met Jack Charlton.
I know, sir.
Why don't you give it to Madge?
Too small for her. She didn't want it. Listen now. You're gone and I'm sending them after you so you can have the use of them.
And one by one, the smart jackets and little hats and silky scarves and blouses blacken on the fire and billow out acrid smoke, rising up out of the small back garden, past the little apple tree that never bore an apple, and away they go, spiralling up the hillside to make a soft landfall in the hanging gardens of Lover's Walk.
You always wanted to move to Montanati. Well, there you are, man.
Gussie brings out the last of his hidden bottles, takes one bracing swig and enlivens the bonfire with the remains before chucking the bottle in the bin.
That's that for me. My last and final drink. Never, ever again.
Over in Blackpool, things are stirring.
Hi, look at your man, Bertie Murphy.
Is he making his move?
I don't know, but he's all spruced up for the middle of a working day.
At lunchtime, Bertie Murphy finally has a chance to go to the builder's suppliers. Doused in the oldest Old Spice.
Christmas 1998, with love from Dora.
He is stalking the aisles of the deserted shop, trailing the manly scent of desperation behind him and searching for plausible stuff to buy while he waits for the counter to be quiet and Misha on duty.
Carriage bolts, yeah, always handy. Them brass countersunk wood screws, yeah. And oh, fat Johnny asked me to pick up some slop hoppers. That'll do, that'll do. And oh, yeah, some sandpaper. Fine. Extra fine. That way she'll know I'm not just a mulliker, but I do tasty work.
Suddenly, she is there, and he approaches the counter again. He now has a tin of shellac sticking out of his pocket and a couple of slop hoppers cradled in one arm.
Hello, Bertie. You're not usually here this time. You're early.
The early worm gets the...
Oh, the early worm gets the bird. Is that it, yes?
Bertie blushes deeply. Jesus, what did he say? But she is still smiling as she scans the items into her machine, smiling as if he has made a joke. He places all his purchases on the counter.
And this, what are these called?
Slop hoppers.
You're joking, yes? You're very funny today.
No. That's what they are, all right. Hoppers for slops, like.
You'll be telling me next you want a left-handed screwdriver. I know you, man. You joke all the time.
Yeah.
Just give me a moment to check price on this.
As she turns to a computer screen beside her, Bertie has time to compose himself and to notice the wonderful shape she makes on her high stool.
You like Mozart?
What?
Mozart, Don Giovanni. You are Don Giovanni, Bertie, the great lover. I never heard your musical before.
You'd be so surprised.
You are a singer, yes? Oh, I love singing. Okay, here's your docket. Sign here for them. Charging, yes? Sign here.
She holds out to him a small stub of a pencil. Bertie signs the docket, but as he goes to hand it back, he is suddenly inspired. He holds it up, transfers it to his other hand, and claps that hand to his mouth and eats it. It's gone.
You eat my pencil. Where'd it go?
He blinks, shrugs, looks at her. She laughs. Then he looks at her left ear, looks puzzled. She frowns, wondering what is wrong. Very slowly, he reaches forward and, with a sudden movement, pulls the pencil out of her ear and hands it back to her. She laughs and claps.
Dirty, you're magic, man.
Only one trick, though.
I don't believe this. I'm sure you have many other tricks. You show me sometime.
Sure.
I would like that, Bertie.
He nods, smiling and blushing to the roots of his thinning hair, turns and takes flight, awkward as a heron, dazzled with happiness, out of the shop and away into the bright afternoon sky. And so it goes, little defeats, little victories, all monitored and watched by the four-faced liar. And as night falls on the town, as sometimes it must, they keep up their vigil.
See that, lad? Too much hurry.
Won't even stop for the Angelus.
Heathens, a lot of them now.
And agnostics.
Are they the ones who don't eat lamb?
No, that's vegans.
Oh. And now it's raining on top of everything?
Morgan O'Carroll is wearing his special gardening jacket and is out in the steamy sanctuary of his greenhouse. Here he can discreetly check the 5, 6 missed messages from Afric.
Oya, Hockey, Miss Miles, Daphne. What's this one? LMIRL42F. What's that? LMIRL. Let's meet in real life. Face to face.
Morgan!
Oh, God.
He shoves the phone into his jacket pocket.
You're all over the TV news.
Icy fingers clutch Morgan's heart.
That mad old lady and her brood is at the funeral.
The icy fingers release their grip and he breathes again.
Oh, what?
Come on, Morgan, you'll miss it.
With shaky step, he goes back in the house and sits transfixed as he watches on the screen a parody of himself apparently shouting at a very old woman.
But all efforts to move the 98-year-old protester proved futile and the Gardaí had to be called. This is Keelan Short O'Carroll for RTE Cork.
That woman is a menace.
Isn't she great, though? Sticking to her guns. What was that?
What?
Is that your phone?
What? Oh, oh, this. Yeah, I suppose so.
But your phone is up in the bathroom. I saw it there. That doesn't sound like your phone. Have you a second phone, Morgie?
No.
Morgan O'Carroll, kindly explain yourself.
Down in the city, as the darkness encroaches and Emer Foley prepares for sleep, wrapped in a blanket, in underneath her narrow bed, she addresses the shadow on the wall, her old eyes glittering with satisfaction.
Oh, I shown him, Dada, didn't I? I shown him.
You did, girl. Mahan Colleen.
Did you see me on the news, Dada? Me? At that funeral?
I did, yeah. I did.
Quislings. And collaborators, I called them.
Have a sleep now. That's right. That's right.
Good night, Dada.
And she closes her eyes and moves majestically into sleep at the head of a great army of bin bags and cardboard placards. On the quayside behind the Everyman Palace, a young couple are waiting for the air coach to Dublin. Ryan still grieves for his 12-year-old Yamaha 150. Caitlin looks up at him and gently strokes the bruise around his left eye. He smiles and folds her into his chest and they huddle together against the encroaching rain.
Ah, will you look at the little rucksacks?
You think they were only going for a message?
Your one's mother thinks she's only going out to the pictures.
And what about his mother?
Neither knows nor cares. Down in Pa Johnson singing.
Oh, sure got to love us.
And the lovers cling together, warmed and giggling, waiting for the bus that will take them away to a life of their own. Across the river, Gussie Barrett is just now finding his majestic way out of the brightness of Creedon's Bar and onto the darkness of Parnell Square.
Good night, lads. Night, Mac. Good luck, Gussie.
See you, Gussie, bye.
Mind yourself, Your Honour. See you tomorrow.
No, that's it now. Giving it up completely.
Go way out of there.
Yeah, just thought I'd drop in for a parting glass, you know. Last few points, eh? Night now.
Parting glass.
And night, Gussie.
Oh, you're nice.
I believe that when I see it. Long,
Gus.
And Gussie saunters grandly towards home like the Lord Mayor he once was. As the evening pulls the night around its shoulders and settles down, the four faces sigh and shift in their stays and ease their springs and gaze down at the city and its rivers.
There's the river now, nice and quiet like. Seen it all, the river has.
Seen it all.
Cattle boats down Penrose Quay.
The human cattle boat, the Inishfallon.
And all the fireworks that time.
And the people emigrating.
And the burning.
You mean the opera house?
No, the real burning. The Oxys and them. The burning of Cork.
Oh, yeah. The city hall and everything.
100 years ago now.
And all the shops that time. Shame it was.
And the night the opera house went. Ah, the poor old opera house. It was beautiful, all curves and gilts.
You're not talking about your one who used to work Emmett Place?
Yeah, she was definitely all curves and gilt.
Shut up. It was beautiful, lovely plump seats.
Yeah, she had one of them too.
Pay no attention to them. You're perfectly right. 100 years it was standing.
And burnt to the ground in a few hours.
Maybe that's the way of it.
What?
Things stand for 100 years and then they burn down. And you start again. Still, it's lovely now.
And the river seen it all.
And the soft drizzle of memory and forgiveness falls on the city as the pubs close and the streets empty, and only the chippers and the clubs glow and pulse like the embers of a great fire. And the city turns again towards sleep.
Hey, there's Gussie Barrett again, look, on the new bridge. Is he pissing in the river again?
No, he's singing.
Listen.
Sounds of wayward in the days of childhood ring round my cradle their magic spells. And this I ponder where'er I wander, and dost grow fonder, sweet cock of thee, while the bells of Shannon sound far more grand on the pleasant waters of the River Lee.
We've been listening to The Four-Faced Liar by Ger Fitzgibbon. The narrator was Andrew Bennett. The four liars were played by Dawn Bradfield, Orla Fitzgerald, Elizabeth Moynihan and Norma Shahan. Dawn Bradfield also played Muriel and Dora. Orla Fitzgerald played Afric, Caitlin and Keelan Short O'Carroll. Elizabeth Moynihan played both Barbara and Gussie's wife. Norma Shahan played Emer Foley and Gartha Karen Crean. Dennis Conway played Gussie Barrett and Bertie Murphy. Alex Murphy played Ryan and Gartha Dan Considine. Gary Murphy played Morgan O'Carroll and Dada. Misha was played by Tatiana Ulyankina. Other roles were played by members of the company. And the original score on saxophone was performed by Brian Wynne. Sound supervision and sound design were by Ruth Kennington. The Four-Faced Liar by Ger Fitzgibbon was directed by Charlie McCarthy. The producer was Kevin Brew, and the series producer of Drama on One is Kevin Reynolds. Extra production support was by Goretti Slaven. And if you'd like to listen back to The Four-Faced Liar, take a look at our website, rte.ie/drama-on-one. An earlier version of this work was originally produced at the Everyman Theatre in Cork as part of the Play It By Ear audio drama series of 2021.
rte.ie/drama-on-one.
Now, if you're a candidate for the 2025 Leaving Cert English paper, you're no doubt aware that the prescribed Shakespeare play is King Lear. You can listen to the 1962 RTE archive production starring Anu McMaster on the Drama on One website, where you can also hear over 60 podcasts about King Lear, including sample answers, scene studies, theme explainers, favourite quotes, not to mention the King Lear quiz where, just like the Leaving Cert, all your favourite questions come up. That's all available on rte.ie/podcasts or search Lear in Lockdown on your podcast app. Here's an excerpt from the podcast. Gillian O'Neill of Sculvora reads her model answer to a statement about King Lear's isolation.
In the play, King Lear moves from a position of centrality to one of loneliness and isolation. The purpose of the introduction is to give your opinion on the statement in the question and hint at the different aspects of the play you might refer to. For example, the play King Lear centres around its protagonist's movement from a king used to total dominance to a frail man. I believe it's true to say that Lear does indeed move from a position of centrality to one of loneliness and isolation. However, I believe Lear goes further and he moves beyond his isolation back to a position of some power. In your answer, you should refer to the question constantly. The focus of the next paragraphs will be the centrality of Lear. In Act 1, Scene 1, line 94, Cordelia is after saying she has nothing to say to her father, and he uses threatening language towards her to assert his control. Mend your speech a little, lest you may marry your fortune. When he faces opposition, he will not tolerate it and flies into a rage. You could also mention that despite what Lear has done to Cordelia and Kent, they remain loyal to him. As Lear inspired such loyalty, we can presume that he had a very central role as king and father. After establishing how Lear was a central figure, you would then move on to his loneliness and isolation. I'm using his state of mind to illustrate how lonely he felt. It is easiest to do this in a chronological order. In Act 1, Scene 4, line 228, we are given an indication that Lear is going mad as he asks, "Does any here know me? This is not Lear." Lear no longer can identify himself as he has lost all the power that he once had. As the Fool illustrates, Lear is now but a shadow of his former self. Another episode you could refer to is when Lear finds Kent in the stocks. In Elizabethan times, the stocks were more than just a form of punishment. They were a symbol of powerlessness. When Lear finds his servant in the stocks, he is on the way to acknowledging that he is powerless. He has nothing and is nothing without his kingship.
Gillian O'Neill of Sculvora there from the podcast Lear in Lockdown. To listen back to this, as well as over 60 podcasts on King Lear, including sample answers, scene studies, theme explainers and favourite quotes, go to the Drama on One website or look for Lear in Lockdown wherever you get your podcasts. And you might like to know that the Gate Theatre in Dublin will stage a production of King Lear starting this weekend, with details on the Gate Theatre's website. Next week's Drama on One is Kerry Plates by Shay Linehan. The series producer of Drama on One is Kevin Reynolds.
rte.ie/drama-on-one